Okay, time is 8:33 a.m. on April 19th, 2022, and I am convening this video conference and telephone conference meeting of the Board of Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guaranty Association. This meeting is being conducted pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act and the Association's antitrust policy. All information disclosed or discussed is to be used only for carrying out the business of the association. Proper notice of the meeting was filed on April 8th, 2022, and published in the Texas Register in accordance with the Texas Open Meetings Act. Copy of the notice should be attached to the summary of the official minutes of this meeting. Quorum is achieved as all seven appointed directors have been confirmed as attending by video or audio conference. Two director positions remain vacant. Also in attendance are Bhakti Patel, principal with Clifton Larson Allen, Board Counsel Shelby Betts, General Counsel Jackie Rickson, the Guaranty Association Executive Director Bart Bowles, and Guaranty Association employees Jarrett Terry and Job Topping Haggerty. And from TDI, we have John Peters, Brian Rewey, Patty Otto, Kanisha Schuster, John Wooding, Caitlin Merrick, and Bain Hugo. So, agenda item number one is consideration and possible action on consent agenda items. Do we have a motion?
President Lewis, this is
Yes.
James Huckabee. So moved.
Ted Kennedy,
This is
second.
Dean. I'll second.
Okay. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Thank you very much. Then I guess it's on to item number two. Just TDI has anything they want to state in open session?
I don't believe we do.
Okay. I didn't think so either, but I just wanted to make sure it hadn't changed. Okay, so on to agenda item number three, and that's the audit committee chair. Dean, you're up.
Yeah, we the audit committee met with Bhakti
Excuse me just one minute.
and
Bart, did you mean to dismiss the
Yes, I'm going to stop sharing. So when Bhakti is ready and Dean asks for her presentation, she can share her screen.
Okay, sorry.
That's fine. Yeah, the audit committee met with Bhakti and went over the results of the audit. The most large item was we reclassified the settlement as an expense instead of a reduction of revenue. It doesn't change the bottom line, but it does change the presentation. And that was the most significant item in the audit. Again, it doesn't change the bottom line. It's just a reclassification. We talked with Bhakti. They didn't have any problems with the audit. It proceeded well. Staff seemed pleased with everything. So with that, Bhakti, will you take a minute and go over the results of the audit, please?
I will. Thank you so much. Good morning, board. Thank you for allowing me to present to you today. I'm going to share my screen here. Give me one moment. Are you able to see my screen here? I'm
Yes.
going to
Yes.
close the,
Yeah.
I'm going to close this here. Okay. Well, good morning, board. I'm here today to present the results of the fiscal year 2021 external audit. As Dean mentioned, we had one large reclassification, otherwise no major issues, but I'm going to go through a little bit more detail, the results of the audit and then the operations on what really happened this year at the agent or at the association. So I'll go through a little bit of our scope of work and deliverables this year, go through our audit results and financial highlights and some required communications I make every year. And then steps for finalization as we finalize the audit after the meeting today. So our scope of work was to audit the financial statements of the Guarantee Association as of and for the year ended December 31, 2021. We do perform limited procedures on management's discussion analysis, which is we refer to as the MD&A. So we read that to make sure it's consistent with those financial statements and note disclosures. But we do perform our audit in accordance with generally accepted accounting standards. We do propose adjusting journal entries. A few of those I'll walk you through on what we proposed this year. And then we also, one of the final things that we'll do that we are doing today is read that final annual report just to make sure it's materially consistent with the financial statements and the note disclosures. We don't audit the other pieces of that annual report, but we do read that. So our audit opinions are really over those basic financial statements. So here's our deliverables. Excuse me. We will deliver the independent auditor's report, which will go right on top of those financial statements that management has prepared. We are required to give internal control communications if we have, if we find any deficiencies in internal control. You'll see an NA here. We didn't find any deficiencies in internal control over any of the areas or any of the or financial reporting. And then we have a governance communication letter that we will send to you as a final deliverable, which really outlines what I'll go over today with you. So the results of our audit, just high level, we have an unmodified opinion, and this is consistent with prior years. That's the highest level of assurance we can give as your independent auditor. So that's to say there are no material misstatements that we identified in those financial statements. We didn't have any proposed uncorrected audit adjustments. Sometimes these come up and we identify these, and we as an auditor agree they're immaterial, management agrees they're immaterial. And for various reasons, we decide not to correct them and reflect them in the financial statements. There are none this year. Any adjustments noted that I will walk you through were corrected in those financial statements. Some of those were small dollars, but they were still corrected. So they're accurately reflected there. We just had those three corrected audit adjustments. And I use audit adjustments as a very loose term as I'll walk you through some of these. As I mentioned, some of these are minor, but still management still corrected them and they are reflected in those financial statements you have today. Our internal control communications, as I mentioned, we are required to communicate any deficiencies that we identify. We didn't identify any deficiencies that we consider to be material weaknesses during our audit. That doesn't mean material weaknesses may exist, which have not been identified. We just didn't identify any as part of our auditing procedures. So we don't have any other written recommendations to management either. One of the things that we do, if they're significant enough, we will report them to the board. But then sometimes we'll find some minor items that we just communicate directly to management. We didn't have any of those as well. So no minor written recommendations or significant enough to report to the board. So I'll go through some of the financial highlights. Those are really the results of the overall, and I'll walk you through those adjustments I mentioned a little later in the presentation, but just what happened this year. Nothing should be new to the board. I believe all of this has gone through the board just due to the magnitude of it all. But on your statement of net position, you'll see it's the first financial statements in the packet you have there. The investments increased $21 million, and this is actually a typo that should have been fixed here. I apologize for that. They increased $21 million due to the purchases of some of the U.S. treasuries in fiscal 21. As you know, there was investments purchased this year. It shouldn't say maturity. It should say purchases. So there was an increase as of December 31, 2021. A right of use lease asset increased $1.3 million, and those lease liabilities increased $1.3 million. So an increase in asset, increase in liabilities. So really a net impact of zero there due to early adoption of GASB 87, which is the new lease standard. So this puts your building lease as an asset on your financial statements and puts a related liability on your financials as well. So management worked through the lease standards, identified one lease that needed to be recorded, and this was recorded there. And we didn't find any issues with that. This was all recorded appropriately. Sure. We also have our net investment capital assets. It does consider that right of use lease asset and related lease liability. I mentioned those really net to zero. There was a small residual amount that kind of stays in there just because of the timing of the amortization, the depreciation or amortization of that asset and the amortization of that lease liability. So that's taken into consideration. One thing I do want to note, and Jared, please jump in to provide any clarification here. Just because of the amortization schedules, that number on your financial statements may turn negative at some point. It has not this year, and I'm gonna change screens here just so I can show you. and provide you with that. So on your statement of net position at the very bottom, did my screen change?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. So you have we have our unrestricted net position. And I apologize for the background noise. I am at a conference today, so I am looking for a quiet place, but there's still some noise out here. So here's our unrestricted net position. This is our net investment or capital assets, this 13,000 you see here. So this is essentially what's invested in capital assets net of any related debt. So that will turn negative because of the timing issue of that asset amortization and that lease liability. It's not wrong. Mm-hmm. It's just a function of how the lease standard is being implemented. It is still positive this year, but it's really a timing issue. It all nets to zero at the end of that lease term. So it's just really a timing issue depending on where we are in the amortization schedule. Let me go back to my slides here. So from the statement of revenues, expenses, and changes in net position, the net position increased about $22 million, largely due to the receipt of a $29.5 million estate distribution, which was that Lincoln Memorial distribution. And it was offset by that $6.3 million settlement payment that Dean mentioned earlier in the presentation here. So that impacted that net position, that bottom line equity, for lack of better words, by $22 million. Those estate recoveries, you'll see that in revenue of $29.2 million. And that's that Lincoln Memorial settlement. And then the $6.3 million settlement, will, as Dean mentioned, we reclassified that as it was initially a reduction in revenue. After working through some accounting guidance with management, we decided that it was best presented as an expense according to some of the standards. And so that was reclassified. And I'll walk through that entry with you in just a moment. Some of our significant footnotes, note 5, membership assessments. This has been here in the past, not a new note, but we did disclose, management did disclose the $1 million Class A assessment that was assessed in fiscal 21. Note 11 is a new note. It's around leases, or the lease part of it is a new note, I should say. So we'll see the $1.3 million right of use lease in that footnote, along with that lease liability. And you'll see a maturity schedule in there as well on the maturity of that lease. And that's the new building that the association has moved into. Note 15 is commitment and contingencies. The Lincoln Memorial settlement of $29.1 million is in that footnote. And then other recoveries, Penn Treaty, other recoveries subject to return and ongoing claims are in there. Not a new note, but the items that were new this year are disclosed in those footnotes. One footnote. Yes, sir.
Were you about to address the settlement?
I was. Okay. Yes. one footnote that's not in here because it came out of our second review. I reported to the audit committee that we were still going through our second review, which is our independent review, just to make sure we haven't missed anything. So it didn't make it into your board packets, but I do want to communicate that change. There was two changes I want to communicate, and this is one of them. Note 13, and I'm going to share my financials too so that you can see those. So this is not in the draft financials you have, so I do want to talk about this real quick. We just disclosed the settlement because it is a material number on those financial statements this year. And I apologize for the scrolling. I'm just trying to get to that footnote. We've put it as note 13. And so any note after that has shifted down. It's a simple, the association made a final payment of $6.3 million under settlement agreement from a prior period. And so really just to disclose that larger amount on those financial statements. So that has been added since that draft that you have in your hands. One other, the second change I want to make note of from that came out of our second review is the draft that you have in your hand. The very last footnote is a subsequent events footnote that says there were no subsequent events. We have taken that out. It's not required under GASB standards unless there is a subsequent event. So it's not required to add that in there and say that there's nothing. So we've taken that out. So those were the only two changes that came out of. There were some minor other underlines and dollar signs and small items that were made from the packet that you have in front of you. But those were the two main changes that I did want to communicate. So I want to pause. Are there any questions on the changes or the results of the operations this year? Okay, I will keep moving on. So our required communications, these are the communications I make every year. So no changes in the scope of audit. We still audit those financial statements, the basic financial statements that management prepared. We did have the new accounting standard GASB 87 that management early adopted this year. We did have a new reporting standard as well, which really impacted us more than you on just some of the inquiries we have to make around management's assessment of going concern beyond a reasonable past a reasonable period. So we did implement that on our end from an auditing standpoint this year. And management did implement GASB 87 this year, that lease standard. And then there was a question around early adopting it and why management decided to early adopt it. As you know, management entered into the new lease this year, and they had already gone through the exercise of identifying the leases and doing the calculations. So since it was all done, we went ahead and early implemented it since the beginning of the lease. It just made it a little bit easier to transition this year. No new accounting policies or changes in existing policies with management this year. At the association, no transactions entered into which there was any kind of lack of authoritative guidance. We also look at your estimates and disclosures pretty closely, especially those estimates, because they are estimates. Of course, they can't be tied back to a specific number. So we look at insurance contractual obligations and the allowance for doubtful accounts. We are comfortable with management's estimates. We looked at any new transactions happening this year, anything that may change those reserve percentages that have been historically used. So we did question management. We worked through all of those and comfortable with those estimates that are in those financial statements. And there aren't any sensitive financial statement disclosures that we identified that are in those financials. excuse me, as Dean mentioned, we didn't have any significant difficulties encountered during the audit. Everything that we were provided, everything timely. Management was very transparent and very open and very responsive to all of our questions. So we certainly appreciate that. That makes our job easier. We know this is not your main job, the audit. So we certainly appreciate that. And I do want to recognize that. We didn't have any disagreements encountered as part of our audit either. We were able to work through any questions that arose. We didn't note that management consulted with other accountants about any other auditing or accounting matters that we were aware of. And no matters were discussed prior to that our engagement that were a condition to our engagement, which essentially means that we are independent. There was nothing discussed prior. We did our audit independently. We will document that management representation letter at the conclusion. Once the board approves this audit, we'll get that management representation letter, which essentially asserts to that we've been given everything to the best of management's knowledge. They haven't held anything back. We'll get that, and then we can final issue once we've done that. And then the three corrected audit adjustments I'm going to briefly go over, I have on the next slide here. So I will walk you through those quickly. So I know this is a lot on the slide, so I apologize, but there's just three here. The first one was just a reclassification between interest income and expense on how that's being reported. Now on those financial statements, this is all reported on one number. So it's a net zero impact on those financial statements. You won't see any, you would not even see this $30,000 number on those financial statements moving if you saw a draft to the final, because it nets to the same number. This was also under our, what we call our trivia, our posting threshold. So even if we could have been fine even passing on this, but management did correct this on their books. The reclassification number two was at settlements. It was originally booked in the income as a reduction in revenue. We reclassified that to that settlement number. So you'll see that $6.3 million in non-operating expenses on the financial statement, in the statement of revenue expenses and changes in that position. And then we had, there was some prepaid rent as part of that lease, as part of the GASB 87 implementation, some prepaid rents that was booked as expense. So we corrected that just to make sure it's a prepaid. These dollar amounts are very small. Again, we would have passed on this, but as we worked through with management, we discussed it and they agreed that they want that accounting to be correct, even though those dollars are very, very immaterial. So that has been corrected and reflected those financial statements.
Baki, yes. May I? Not only could these have been passed and not been corrected, we chose to correct them, but the first and third items there, because of materiality, normally you would not even raise those in this report. Correct. But we specifically ask that you bring them to the attention of the board. Full transparency, we want the board to know everything that's going on in the audit.
Correct. Thanks, Bart, for that. So just for the board's information, from an audit standpoint, excuse me, we have several levels of materiality, for lack of better words here, that we use. One is what we call our trivial. So these are the things that if we find small errors that we won't even bring them up to management. We'll just pass on those in our work papers. They're immaterial enough that we wouldn't even present those. We have another, anything above that threshold, we would present to management and ask them to consider posting it, or we could still even pass on those because there's a third level that we do want to make sure that those are posted because they could materially misstate those financial statements. So these were even under that lowest level that we wouldn't even honestly bring up to management to pass on. We did discuss everything and these are reflected in those financial statements. But correct, management did ask me to present those just for full transparency. So this is it. This is everything. There's nothing in there, any kind of materiality levels that have been left off here. So steps to finalization, we'll be reviewing that final annual report. Like I mentioned, we'll read it just to make sure everything's materially consistent with those financial statements. We don't audit those, but we do just read those. We'll have our final subsequent events discussions with management today just to make sure nothing's happened since we finalized our testing and there's nothing else to disclose here, but we've kind of updated those communications as we've gone and nothing up to date. So we do have to do those up to the report date. So we'll do that today. And then of course, today's board approval of the reports, and then we will get that representation letter signed. And once we're able to do that, we will issue that. Our second review, when I presented the audit committee last week, I believe we were in the process of our second review. That has been completed and she has signed off. So once we finish these final steps, we should be ready to issue once the board approves. So that's everything. I want to make sure I have time to take any questions if anyone has any.
Yeah, Baki, that second review, where is that done?
Where as in?
Is it the same office or a different office?
It's actually a different office. So I apologize. I'm going to stop sharing here so I can get back to the screen. It's a different office. So how CLA does their second review is we have what we call our pool, and we have experts in that industry. So we call for this, it would be our GASB technical pool. And so they're experts in GASB financial reporting. So it goes into the pool and those are the reviewers. And this year I drew the lucky star. I got the head of that group. So she's about the smartest as I get when it comes to GASB reporting. So she asked those questions. So it goes to that group of folks and they're scattered across our offices around the US. But it is a specific group.
Yeah, that's one thing we liked about your firm is that second independent review of the numbers. Any other questions for Baki? Well, we appreciate the job you did, Baki. Look forward to working with you next year.
I appreciate it.
The next item we need to consider is to approve the audit. You've got a resolution on your screen right now. Is there a motion to accept the audit?
Harrison, so moved.
Sommer, second.
Sorry, I was Jim. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Thank you very much. Back to you, Dean.
Yeah, we also looked at the expanding the audit plan for next year, the 22 audit plan, but we reviewed it and accepted it as is. We did talk a little bit about hiring a second consultant to do a review on policy and claims administration, and I think we can reconsider that in October, but we didn't take any action on that. Mm-hmm. We also looked at the budget variance report, and most of the variances were where you expected. Our share of the Nogal expenses. Did I say that right, Bart?
Yes. Well, there was a little attributable to the change in staffing and implementation of GASB that we had not anticipated how it would impact some of the budgeted items, but very small variances.
Yeah, and they're all quite explainable. And then we also reviewed our audit charter, and we have no recommendations for changes. And unless there are questions, that concludes my report.
And I think we can go ahead and let Bakti go. She seems to be very busy today.
Thank you, Bakke, for all you do.
Thank you, everyone.
We are on to item number 4, which means I have language to read. The time is 8:58 a.m. on April 19th, 2022, and I am recessing the regular session of the Board of Directors meeting of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association in order for the board to meet in executive session pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act. Okay, the time is 9:40 a.m. on April 19th, 2022. The executive session of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association Board of Directors meeting has concluded, and I am reconvening the regular session of the meeting pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act. And the next item on the agenda is item 5, consideration and possible action on items discussed in the executive session. And we don't have any action that needs to be taken. So it's on to item number 6. Quarterly report from Bart.
Yes, Chair Lewis, this will be brief. First, I'll give you a little update on some operational matters. Our COVID response and COVID operations, the offices still remain in somewhat of a closed status. I am here daily. Topping is in at least twice a week, and Jarrett once a week. It's just there are some items that we have to do in person. But as the COVID cases have diminished somewhat in Austin, we are looking that after Memorial Day, we will move back to regular operations of the office. Now, it's going to be regular operations in the new world, which we are going to do some remote working, but everyone will work it 3 days a week in the office. There'll be 1 day each week we will all be in the office. So the good thing to note for the association is whether we're in the office or not, with our remote capabilities now, we don't lose a step. We can do everything. The only thing we can't do is handle fiscal items that come in the mail. All right. I have no update on timing of an examination of the association from TDI. Materials have been submitted, and we stand ready whenever we're notified that that will begin. TDI has said it could be in 2022 and it could be in 2023. But I'll just keep you advised if that changes. We still have 2 vacancies on the board of directors, and the Department of Insurance continues to work to fill those vacancies. It's not easy finding directors. It's a difficult task, and I applaud the TDI for their efforts. Meetings that have occurred that are coming up, the last thing I mentioned, NEIC meeting was just held in Kansas City. I did not attend this meeting. Just looking at the agenda, there was very little that I thought would warrant the registration fees. Although I've been communicating with some that attended, it seemed like the meetings are getting back to the normal, where there's a lot of hallway discussions and peripheral meetings that are beneficial. So my attendance remotely or not attending these meetings may change in the future. I did attend the IAIR resolution workshop in Santa Fe, second week of February. It was the first event that IAIR had held in person since COVID began. It was a hybrid meeting. We had virtual attendees, in-person attendees, virtual presenters, and in-person presenters. I was asked the week before the meeting to handle the IT. So I coordinated with the hotel, and we were able to do everything virtually on screen and through Zoom, and it worked pretty well. But I went to school a little bit and learned some lessons on how to do these hybrid events in this new age, because I think that's going to be going forward, not just because of COVID. These are going to be more and more commonplace. Speaking of virtual and hybrid meetings, NOLGA will be having their first in-person MPC meeting next Monday and Tuesday in Indianapolis. I will not be attending. I will be attending virtually, and I'll be presenting virtually. This meeting is unique in that on Monday afternoon, it is a four-hour educational session, and we're calling it Insolvency Fundamentals 101. With so many new Guaranty Association administrators across the country, over the last year and a half, there's been a lot of training on operations of your association, handling your office, governance procedures, things like that. But there has been a gap in the new administrator's understanding and knowledge of receivership activities, how task forces work, how the MPC works. So we are doing a full afternoon next Monday on that. I am heading up one of the sessions, which deals with really task force operations and how the MPC works. And I think it's going to be a good program. It's been a lot of work to pull together and coordinate, but we're ready to go. So that will be next Monday afternoon. Monday morning, there is a Penn Treaty Task Force meeting, but if any of you would like to attend, I would say Tuesday would be a very good day. That's when the general MPC meeting will occur, and there'll be updates on Penn Treaty, Global Bankers, Time, SHIP, really the troubled companies and some of their active insolvencies right now. But that's next Monday and Tuesday. If anyone's interested in attending, and there will be a virtual attending possible, just let Topping or I know. We'll get you some information. And last thing I'll mention, I did do my annual presentation to an LLM class at the UConn Law School. I did it on March 30th. And a very interactive and very active class this year. It's a small class. There's usually around a dozen or so. But they have a lot of questions on how guaranty associations work and public policy and things of that nature. So I believe it's worthwhile. And another year, I think it's my seventh year of doing it. So it worked pretty well. And that's all I have on general operational items from me. If there are any questions, I'll be glad to entertain them.
I guess we're on to item seven, consideration possible action regarding the 2021 annual report.
Yes, and Jim Topping pulled together the annual report. Jarrett Topping do a lot of the drafting on this. I have some parts that I compile. Of course, Jim does his letter from the chair, but Topping put the draft report in your packet. We will be adding the final audit report from the auditor, and we have pages resolved in there to insert them. But I don't know if there's anything I need to point out. There didn't appear to be anything momentous in this year's annual report, and we did not alter the format this year. But if anyone has questions on the material that was distributed, we'll be glad to answer your questions.
Mark, the only thing I saw were in a couple of places, there were missing periods and sort of things like that. And I think I remember you and Topping saying that whoever actually prints this thing or does, or I guess since it's going out by email, maybe not, but that somebody does another review for nits like that.
Yes, before we finalize it completely, we do have a proofreader read it for all of our small errors.
Okay.
Oh, I just noticed an XX.
Yeah, that's because we don't have the page numbers yet for the official audit. So I make sure that, so I don't accidentally get the wrong page numbers because it's not always exactly the same.
Okay. Other questions?
It looks good, actually. I need to print it and read it more closely and just remind myself everything y'all do all year. It's a lot of work.
Thank you, Patty. And we will always take your suggestions for anyone, any director, on items that should be mentioned or format, or if you want it to look a little different, either for this year or next year. Feel free to channel those thoughts to us.
Are there any other comments, or should we consider a motion on the resolution? Anybody?
So moved, Mr. Chair. Jane Tuckabee.
Yeah, this is Dean. I'll second.
Okay. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Thank you very much. Motion passes. And on to item number 8. This is Bart.
Yes, item 8, we're going to discuss just a little bit of some of our specific insolvent company activity. Just as an overview, on the page on the screen, I want to point out in 2021, where you see the number that we paid policy obligations of $334,887, you have to remember that that does not include the amounts paid through the captive for Penn Treaty, because we have already funded our amounts to the captive. For Penn Treaty during 2021, we paid $10.8 million in benefits. So it is pretty substantial. And there where you see the first 2 months of 2022, we paid $20,433 of policy obligations. Those are for insolvencies other than Penn Treaty. There in those same 2 months for Penn Treaty, it was about $2.6 million. So I wanted to point out that these numbers don't include the Penn Treaty because we're not funding those. Those have already been funded in our financing and support that we provided to our captive LTC Re. I do need to point out under the distributions and recoveries here, in 2021, $29.5 million of recoveries. Of course, there was a litigation settlement that was well over $29 million of that. So that was a pretty significant activity in recovery. And I know the Assessment Investment Committee is working on those amounts and the options for the association on how to handle those funds. And then the other reports are always included. Our activity report on emails. Get to the right page. Here we go. Emails, website visitors, and phone calls. We still get a lot of phone calls referred to us by the Department of Insurance for information that we can't provide because we don't have access to some of the information previously were available to us. And we like to help those consumers. We just can't. And we do what we can by searching through the internet, but we do handle a lot of calls that are really none of our obligation. So let me move on and talk about three specific insolvencies. The Penn Treaty American Network, I treat them as one, but there are two separate companies. And on Penn Treaty, I'm going to put on screen, these are the national and Texas only numbers for March 1, 2017 through February 28th. 2022. So we're talking 59 months since liquidation began. And you can see nationally for all the guarantee associations except for Illinois, Wisconsin, and Hawaii, because they administer their obligations directly, $445 million in premiums collected, $1.18 billion in claims payments, and $132 million in cash buyout payments. So you can see that $1.3 billion in benefits paid by the Guarantee Association system. This association is right at $71 million. So there's a lot of benefits that have been paid. My group, the Policy and Claims Administration Working Group, we call it PACA, We monitor all the TPA activities. We're the primary contact with the TPA, and I do put out a quarterly report on all administrative metrics and tracking. One of the things we track is how many policyholders have exhausted their guarantee association coverage. And as you can see, through the end of February, we have 961 policies nationally that have gotten to at least 75% of their guarantee association statutory coverage limit. 448 of those have fully exhausted their coverage. That may sound like a lot, but you have to remember we began with 71,000 policies, and we now have 41,000 policies. So of the 30,000 policies that have terminated since liquidation, only 448 of those are because they've exhausted their guarantee association coverage. Rate increases continue to be implemented, and I think this was a huge win for the system, and it had to be handled pretty well. Because if you look at the numbers, 70,758 rate increase packages have been sent out through the end of February this year. 21,815 of those receiving packages called to have questions, and only 101 complaints were filed. And I don't put it on here, but there were actually two letters of thank you that were submitted, which is kind of unusual for a rate increase, but we did get two. Escalated matters. This is just anything that's a second level appeal or a regulatory complaint or anything with threatened litigation does escalate to PACA. And we review and prepare a specific response for the guarantee association that is affected to review before it's sent back out to the policyholders. It's just, we call them escalated matters. It's a higher level kind of high priority issue, and we make sure we give them special handling. We've had 189 of those flow through the committee since we began March 2017. And we continue to see, you know, anywhere from 3 to 4 or 5, sometimes 10 a month. Service level standards, let me put up this schedule. You remember there are 25 service level standards with our TPA under our service agreement. And on those standards, they have standards they have to meet quarterly. PACA monitors those and then reports them to the Coordination and Strategy Committee. I also serve on that committee. There have been, since COVID began, some failures by the TPA to meet the service level standards. Primarily, they've occurred in the call center just because of people leaving the workplace and also trying to train call center personnel on a new administration platform. We transitioned to a new platform in April of 2021. And you've got to imagine working on a new platform, where do I go to get the information to respond to these calls? It did bog down and really hurt the call center. There have been misses that have been addressed by the CNS committee. Several of those were waived in the first and second quarters of 2021. One financial penalty was applied. There are right now, and for the third and fourth quarters of 2021, 3 potential penalties are pending. The CNS committee asked that we continue to monitor through the first quarter of 2022. I just finished that report after publishing this material for the board. I will tell you that the average speed of answer for the call center, where 85% of calls had to be answered within 1 minute, they did not meet that in the first quarter of 2022. They were at 78.3%. So there are now 4 pending misses for the CNS committee to consider. I will say that they have continually improved on performance in their service level standards. And we do have some call center professionals represented on the PACA committee and on the CNS committee from industry. And they were saying in their call centers, they are not performing this well, that our TPA is doing quite well in the COVID world and in the workforce situations that we're all facing. So we'll wait to see what the CNS committee does on these matters, but I'll let you know they are still pending. Quick update on the wellness pilot program that was implemented December 10th. A little over 6,300 policyholders have been offered the opportunity to participate in this pilot program. I put in there a 14.3 engagement rate. I just had a call with our wellness program vendor, Assured Allies, last week. We're a little bit over 21% now. So the engagement is moving on, but these mailings went out in tranches. So it takes some time for the policyholders to consider this. And sometimes they don't even know they've gotten this mail until a family member comes over and helps them go through their mail. So it takes some time. I mentioned 102 interventions have been prepared. We're now up to about 175 have been prepared or in process of being offered to the policyholders. And the interventions are varied. They may be home modifications. They may be coaching. They may be very simple counseling and providing information on various services available in their communities. But it's too early to tell, but we're very hopeful this is going to have a very positive impact on the aging in place of these policyholders. And if that occurs, then our claims obligations may even be reduced. But we will be monitoring this over the next 18 months to 2 years.
Hey, Bart.
Yes.
Have you gotten from the few that are participating? I mean, has there been any feedback from the policyholders? Do they appear satisfied?
They have. We have not done a survey yet, but we've received calls from many of them, and they're very happy. Even some of their friends have called and say, how do I get in on this? We even had a few people call that want to get the newsletter that was developed. It goes out to these policyholders, and these people asking for the newsletter are not even Penn Treaty policyholders. They just, my neighbor has this. That's a great newsletter. Can I get it? So it's not across the board a survey yet, but we're getting very positive feedback on the modifications and enhancements and interventions that have gone out. Very positive feedback on that. And the modifications, Patty, go from everywhere from grab bars or railings on stairs. It may be non-slick surfaces in their restrooms, could be transfer benches. There are a lot of different things. We've only had two of those modifications rejected, but they were rejected by the family member of the policyholder because they didn't like the aesthetic of what it looked like in their home. So so far, Patty, long story short, very positive.
I will mention, Bart, if your ears are burning last week at the Talhi regulatory roundup, I was at a round table with a long-term care company representative, and they were all excited saying, you know, has anybody heard about the Penn Treaty wellness pilot? And we're looking to do something. It was in the discussion with the regulators about repeal of the rebate or modification of the rebate prohibition.
Yep.
It could be some active carriers worried about that provision and whether it would impact their ability to provide these services. But anyway, there's lots of it. I just want to share it in terms of positive buzz going around about the fact that Penn Treaty is piloting this program and the impact on their policyholders. So
yeah, it's very interesting how many people are watching this program. You know, wellness programs have been around in the managed care community for a while, and they're a little slow to be developed in the long-term care marketplace. Guaranty Association, we're not one of the leaders, but we are early on in wellness. I just came back from a long-term care conference, ILTCI in Raleigh, and a lot of questions about our program there. And so we'll see how this works out. But I will say the regulatory aspect of this, there was a white paper came out with regulatory concerns about wellness programs while we were developing our contract with this vendor. We went through each one of those concerns and evaluated if we had those issues in our program, and we do not. So rebating that you mentioned, ours does not qualify as a rebate. So I think this is going to be a program that others are going to want to replicate. Okay, two other things I'll mention. TriPlus approached PACA, and I'll just cut it short. After some reviews, extensive review, and I went through a demo of their program, we agreed to allow them to implement a speech analytics pilot program for the phone calls coming in on the Penn Treaty block. The good thing is here, they can use this to enhance the training they do for their call center reps, but it also implements a much higher quality assurance review. So through the speech analytics, all calls are analyzed. Where right now it's less than 15% of phone calls actually go through QA. So we think this will be a very good program, but we had to spend about a month going through and double checking all the security around how the information was transferred within their company. PACA is in the process of developing a request for interest for an electronic visit verification program. That will probably go out the door within the next month. I just saw the last version of the request for interest this morning, and it's very close to being finished. EVV is very important when you have a lot of home health care claims involving private caregivers or family caregivers. And of the 2,300 claims active in Penn Treaty right now that involve home health care, 60% of those are with private caregivers or family caregivers. And we're seeing about 75 more per month in that category. We've even had a couple of cases involving overt fraud, and we've had some special investigation going on and some surveillance, and have negotiated the surrender of the policies with those policyholders. EVV is not intended to be a gotcha situation. It's intended to do a couple of things, be a deterrent. And for anyone that is looking to bend the guidelines a little bit and maybe get some benefits that should not be paid, but it does also tighten up and prevent what I call claim seepage, where a claimant may be charged for 6 hours of a caregiver's time when they were only there maybe 5 hours and 15 minutes. The EVV reporting is much more accurate, and it's going to make sure the policyholders can manage their remaining benefits very carefully. And we won't go into detail, but the excess benefits litigation in Pennsylvania, what we call from the Warren Tech case and a property and casualty insolvency, continues. We're just waiting for it to be argued at the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. Any questions on Penn Treaty? A brief comment on Lincoln Memorial. Jarrett and Topping and I are reviewing images for the 49 policies that are still in force. These are Lincoln Memorial policies. Face amounts totaling $68,000. They are being administered by the SDR, but we're looking at the images to do two things. To see if all these policies are still in force, and sure enough, I have found several of them that the policyholders are deceased and claims were in process but never completed. So they're incomplete claims. That make the ongoing administration a little bit simpler. We'll have to try to complete those claims. But then I also found there were over a dozen of these people that were more than 100 years old. And so I started with those 107, 108, 109 years old and started doing obituary searches. Sure enough, I found some. So deaths have occurred, but the claims have not been filed. So that list of 49 policies may trim substantially. And once we can clean it up to what we think are active policies, and we will evaluate whether we have sufficient images, we will move to bring those policies in-house for continued administration. And we'll discontinue our service agreement with the TPA. I can't give you a timeline on it because there's a lot to research here. And the last thing on Calanthe is just tell you where we are. It may not look like a lot of money, but with Topping and Jarrett, it requires a lot of their time. These claimants call a lot. There's a lot to explain. There's a lot to walk them through on the documentation and to research. We have a lot of missing documents, and we have to, and Topping does most of this, have to kind of recreate the wheel and find out what we have here as a policy. But you can see there have been 103 cash renders paid, 46 death claims. All told, we've paid out a little over $100,000 in benefits. There are $800,000 in remaining reserves on the active 2,137 policies. I do not anticipate that we will pay anything close to those reserves. It's just a lot of these policies, very small amounts, may never be benefits come due on them. So we'll continue to administer them. I will probably unless there is a substantial change, discontinue regular reporting to you on them, because it will just be an ongoing runoff. We may go to just an annual reporting. Here's the latest on client pay. And Chair Lewis, that's all I have on the insolvencies to report to you today.
Any questions? Okay, then on to item number 9, corporate governance issues.
Okay, this will be very quick. Topping did distribute the annual conflict of interest business ethics questionnaires and the antitrust certifications for all the board of directors, all employees, and our consultants and vendors. And to date, we only have one outstanding responder. We'll be following up with them, but it's not a director. It's one of our vendors, and they're notoriously slow to respond. We'll be following up with them, but do not anticipate a problem. For all those that have submitted their information, there have been no issues identified that warrant additional follow-up. So our annual review for conflicts and antitrust issues is almost complete, and what's submitted has been just fine. Then I'll remind the board that all directors have to file their personal financial statements directly with the Texas Ethics Commission by May 2nd this year. April 30th falls on a weekend, so Monday, May 2nd is the filing deadline. I know that several of you have already filed your personal financial statements, and that's great for you early birds. Please, if you have any questions, you can contact Topping or I, but we will probably refer you to the Ethics Commission because this is their process. And don't submit them to us, submit them to the Ethics Commission.
They're pretty good at answering questions.
Hey, Bart, it's Patty. I will mention that it's my understanding there was a recommendation made to TDI to include in their biennial report to the legislature to eliminate the personal financial statement requirement for both the life, health, and the property casualty guarantee fund, because it makes it so difficult to, it's just another obstacle to attracting board participation since we're now have two open seats. I think it was Texas Mutual had reached out to me about it, and I thought that might've been submitted. So I don't know if TDI is going to do that, but I do think that it's a challenge. I mean, it's just one additional thing that you have to tell someone that they have to complete. And it seems to me to be somewhat overkill for the role that we serve. But anyway, I just thought I'd mention it.
Patty, this is Ted. I heard the same thing, and to the extent that it's a topic for discussion or consideration, we, for one, would be happy to help further that cause. And
I appreciate the comment. I will say that Commissioner Gieslin, former Commissioner Gieslin, years ago, he and I had talked about this. He was not in favor of these filings, but he said, once it's in the law, it's kind of hard getting it out of the law. Maybe we could go to the commission and ask them to amend the extensive reporting to something that makes more sense. So you might just put that, if there's any pushback about changing the law to eliminate this provision, maybe there can be something to just change the reporting a little bit, because the information, there are other ways to identify whether there are conflicts than the personal financial statements that you're required to file.
I mean, it's those are tailored towards elected officials whose roles may involve all kinds of legislation impacting any possible industry. So versus our role is so limited, it seems like you could file a statement to confirm you don't have investments in companies that do services for us or in related. That's a good point, Bart. But I do feel like that the long-term open seats creates an argument that maybe it should be revisited by the legislature.
Well, and I'll applaud you company individuals at your companies, and you are willing to serve. I do know of several large national companies that have approached me and asked about vacancies on our board. But when they see the personal financial statement filing, they say, no, we'll never serve. So it is an impediment at times. And Chair Lewis, that's all I have under item 9.
Okay, on to item 10. Jarrett's going to review some the financial statements.
Uh-oh.
Oh.
I don't know what happened there, Jarrett.
Okay. Well, I can just hit the big items and describe what's going on. So just go ahead and go back up so we can see the notes. No, the other way. Start on page 10-2.
You can't see them.
Well, so that first item there, that reinvestment of the treasury that matured in 12/31.
Hang on just a moment, Jarrett. Let me see if I can't find a different file that has that.
Okay.
Give me just a moment. I don't know. I didn't notice that was corrupted because I hadn't gone through that until just now. Apologize for the delay, but
do you want me to share my screen?
I think I've got it now. Give me just a second. It's coming up.
Okay.
Let the spinning wheel of death finish. Hang on.
Know where that sound is coming from?
Yes.
Okay.
That's mine. Sorry, our landscape guys came today for some reason. Jarrett, you may have to. It's still spinning.
All right, let me see here. Is it showing up yet? I cannot see on my screen.
It is showing up. It's very small.
Very small.
If you just makes a view bigger.
Is that better?
It's better. I don't know if everyone can see it.
I can see it fine, Jarrett.
Yeah. Okay.
That looks good.
So let me start with the first item there, the reinvestment of the treasury that matured on 12/31. So that's in accordance with board directions where we try to keep around $2 million in cash and money market funds and the rest in treasuries. So we reinvested a treasury there that reduced the cash and increased the investments. The next item is prepaid rent. If you remember from Bhakti's presentation, that's a new account that we needed to create for GASB 87. Because we pay our rent in advance, we have to set up a prepaid rent so that the depreciation and the amortization is recorded in the correct period. So that account will be going forward. The next item we have there is the investment in deferred compensation. So this is the 457B plan, and the board authorized a contribution at the January meeting. And you can see that contribution was made in January per the board directions. Go to the next page, 10-3. We've mentioned that the Lincoln Memorial litigation settlement payment was received in 2021. Those funds were invested in treasuries which is going to lead to an increase in the unrealized gain and loss. So normally that number right there had been much smaller because we had around $30 million invested in treasuries. We're now up to $64 million. So that number is doubled. So that's just to let you know why there's a big change in that number. And if we go to the next page, 10-4. So on the cash flow statement, you'll see right here that there is a large increase in their intercompany borrowing. That's due to the board's decision to borrow expense funds instead of doing the Class A assessment. And then we'll look at that again at the July board meeting. I don't have any other notes to bring up unless anyone has any questions.
Thanks, Jarrett. That looks easy to understand. Good job.
Thank you.
So, Jarrett, I'm ready to share my screen again. All right. The pages aren't corrupted. Thank you. Okay. We'll pass the financials. Now, Jim, we're on item 11.
Right. Consideration of possible action regarding the 2022 calendar of activities. Looks like the next meeting is scheduled for July 26th. We have any conflicts that people know of right away?
I was going to ask. I thought Bart mentioned that's the first potential in-person, except I rearranged my summer schedule for vacation and completely blanked out, and I'm going to be on vacation, so I can participate, but I'll probably be virtual. So if that's still an option at that meeting.
We are planning meetings going forward that we're going to continue to offer remote attendance. So we are looking at having this July meeting as an in-person meeting, but for any directors that don't want to travel or have something come up or you have some other activities but can share a few hours, we will have the ability for you to attend virtually.
Okay, that'd be perfect. Oh, so I had a weird feeling when I shifted my vacation and I just blanked out. I can't believe it. But I will do it from the road from the hotel. So thank you.
Gotcha.
Anybody else?
Good for me.
I believe that's the last item on the agenda, right?
That is it.
So unless someone has something else we need to bring up, I will adjourn the meeting.
Hey, Chair Lewis, James Huckabee. Is there a committee? Are there committee meetings that week or week before?
There will actually be 2 weeks before, Jim. Okay. They will be July. I can find them right here. I've got them on the calendar, so let me get there.
I believe they are the Personnel and the Assessment Investment Committees.
And they are scheduled for?
The 12th?
The 12th.
Yeah, and those are still going to be
virtual
online, right?
They will be virtual.
Yeah. So there won't be any committee meetings that you have to travel for.
Correct.
Right.
That really seems to work well. It allows us to have the committee meetings far enough in advance that whatever you decide in those meetings, we have time to present it to the board. And I think that's why we decided to leave them virtual.
Sounds good.
Okay, well, the time is 10:24 a.m. on April 19th, 2022, and this meeting of the Board of Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association has been held pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act is adjourned.